We shot a video a week or two ago, Zoran and I, about his scaffolding,
Wait, really?
initiative. Yeah.
Oh,
I mean, I don't know if this
they
is,
didn't tell me this.
yeah. I don't know where, I don't
Okay.
know what happened to it. Geopolitical incident that
A World War III.
yeah, that got in the way
Okay.
of the
So
rollout.
we're now leaking this. So we are media, so we're leaking this to force Zoran to release the video, the
Yeah.
scaffolding video. Welcome to Doomscroll. I'm your host, Joshua Citarella. My guest is John Wilson, a filmmaker and documentarian. He is the director of a new movie, The History of Concrete. Today's program is part of the 82nd Whitney Biennial, curated by Marcela Guerrero and Drew Sawyer at the Whitney Museum in New York City. You're already a successful filmmaker and documentarian.
Wow.
What was, I mean, you have a show, you've made movies. What was the struggle with getting funding for this movie?
I think I'm especially bad at pitching things a lot of the time
Really?
because, yeah, I think it's a miracle that How 2 was greenlit in the first place. I think I had a lot of help from having Nathan next to me because he's much, I think, much more articulate in these spaces. You know, I feel like the concrete idea, you know, when I first went around and pitched it, it was much more the PBS version of it, where
Okay.
I was really just like giving you the hard facts and letting you know that, you know, we were going to do it in the same style, you know, which kind of creates its own mystery and alchemy, and we end up with something like always, you know, it's like a proven formula that we've done over and over again. But I also feel like if I had to pitch any one of the episode titles from the show as a standalone, I would have had the same problem.
Was there is there something about maybe the streaming economy and how this has shaped documentary in the last few years where you've got a track record, you've done, you know, 3 seasons of a successful show. That seems like it should speak for you, but there's this big hurdle to get, you know, any amount of money to make your movie.
Yeah, you'd think that.
You would.
But it's you kind of have to start from scratch in a lot of ways with a lot of these projects. And you know, I remember when I first committed to this title, you know, I always start with a title with anything, and I will tell the title to someone at a bar or a friend at a party, and if enough people laugh when you first say it to them, I think that's a really good sign.
Okay.
And because it's usually some kind of like colloquialism that anyone can relate with. And when I told people about the history of concrete, I think they would immediately laugh, but I think for the first time, more out of pity that I was pursuing this
It does, to
idea.
be honest, it does sound like the most boring topic you could possibly make
Well,
a documentary about.
yeah, that's what was, well, when I first came up with the title, the first thing I did was look on Amazon to see if there were any other books or movies out there with the same title. And I found one book called The History of Concrete. And when I looked at the description, it was actually just an empty book with that History of Concrete on the spine of it. And it was a place to store your valuables. Because,
Because
so
it's
like,
so
yeah,
boring, people
like,
wouldn't think to look inside
yeah.
the container.
Not even the most
Jesus Christ, John.
determined thief would dare to
Okay.
open that
So
book.
you're struggling to pitch the most boring topic ever made in maybe the history of documentaries. And a lot of the movie is actually you and the producers on Zoom calls trying to pitch that movie to people. That's a pretty unusual decision. Why did you decide to include that material?
You know, I didn't really include any audio from them or anything, but I just wanted to show, just give like the general idea of what it looks like to just kind of sit and be in these kind of rooms that are hard to like get anyone's emotional read or anything. You know, like the first time I pitched the title to my agent, no one even cracked a smile. And it was really painful, and I knew that it was going to be really hard.
I mean, it sounds like you set yourself up for it a little bit.
Well, yeah, I think there's something really masochistic about. Mm-hmm. I think committing to any one of these ideas, which I really like, because then you that's the challenge, is digging yourself out of the hole.
Yeah.
Of this, you know, of this idea that that you may be the only one believing in, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, at a point.
And so it worked.
I mean, what did Melania just do? Like 7 million?
Oh, God, I don't even know.
We have to beat Melania.
No one will watch it with me.
Yeah. You heard.
Okay.
You hear that?
What is Peanut World?
Peanut World is a production company that I just started with Clark Filio and Sherelle Kozak, two good old friends that worked on How To and produced it.
Why did they call it that?
Peanut World is a store, is my favorite store in Atlantic City. It's right on the boardwalk, and they have a bunch of amazing old bootleg Sharper Image products that have been there since the 80s. And they also sell peanuts.
Okay. That was a much more interesting story than I anticipated.
But there's also a line within The Concrete Movie where I'm talking to a cab driver in Los Angeles where I'm asking him about in new formulas to concrete, you know, that he may have heard of. And he mentions that he heard that they have been using ground up peanut shells to subsidize the strength of concrete somehow.
Oh, right. Is that real?
I don't know. I tried to do as little research as possible at a point. And, you know, I read one really good book about concrete, and then...
Was it the empty one that had the stuff in it?
Well, no. That was the only one called The History of Concrete.
Okay.
There's another one just called Concrete by this guy, Rhys Paley.
Okay.
And it's really good. And he is a really fascinating character if you look him up. But, you know, in the intro to his book, he wrote that, you know, I wanted to write this book about concrete because I looked around and I saw that no one else had, you know, and I found that really inspiring. And, you know, whether or not people wanted to think about concrete, I think it's important to, like, to have that out there and to make something that you haven't really seen.
So this will sound a little bit like a topic change, but I promise it's going to connect back okay. in a moment. You mentioned Las Vegas before.
Mm-hmm.
Famously in How To, you purchase your landlord's building when she moves to Las Vegas.
Yeah.
She's a crowd favorite character called Mama. Is Mama a real character?
In what way? She's not AI.
Is she, well, is she actually your landlord? Did you actually watch The Bachelor together?
Or we watched Jeopardy together.
Jeopardy, yeah. Right. Sorry. And then she moved to Las Vegas.
Yes. Yeah. My landlord. Well, I had two different landlords, I guess. The old woman lived in the basement, and her daughter lived on the first floor.
Right.
And I kind of interfaced with both of them in equal amounts. But yeah, they got tired of shoveling outside of their place and just like dealing with just like the winter in general and other things. And they said that they wanted to move to a planned community in Vegas,
mm-hmm.
you know, that I visited a few times, and I don't know, it's a very different vibe. But I know a lot. I've heard a lot of people from Queens moving to Vegas after they've grown up there and, you know, had enough.
Later on in How To, I don't know, I think it's towards the end, but you're kind of pulling back the veil on the show, and you say that in that episode when you were going to purchase the building from Mama, that actually that was a narrative line for the show, and it wasn't actually real, that you thought it was silly, but people had believed it.
Oh, wait, what?
However, in The History of Concrete, it does appear that you have purchased a building in Ridgewood, Queens, mm-hmm. from your previous landlord.
Yeah.
Which is Mama.
Wait, I'm confused about what you are pulling from.
There's an episode in How To where you say that that narrative of you buying the building from Mama was just for the show and it wasn't actually real.
No way. That never happened.
There's a moment where really?
Well, definitely not. There was one scene where I think I made a mistake with this, with How To, where
yeah.
There was one episode in How to Watch Birds where I admit to fabricating a shot of a toilet exploding.
Yes.
And that has done so many crazy things about people's perception of this work, mm-hmm. where they think that everything is fake, or
yes.
they Mandela effect weird mm-hmm. things that they thought mm-hmm. were fake in
and
the show.
You're saying that I'm doing that?
And yeah, and you're doing that now.
No, you say in the show that you thought it was ridiculous that people would have believed it.
That I bought the building?
Yeah. But you did buy the building because it's in the history of concrete.
Yeah, I did buy the building.
Yeah, and you have two tenants in yes. the documentary named Clark and Nelly.
Yeah.
And those people are real.
Yes. Everything is real.
Okay, and you also...
I admitted to a toilet exploding being fake because I wanted to become closer to the audience in the way that you do with a friend, you know, when you admit something, you know? But it was only to show how committed I am to not faking anything else in the show.
Okay.
Because it is all real. And, you know, I don't mean to get defensive, but yeah, it's this kind of thing that I don't know, like, why it's kind of mutated, like, so much. Because, like, I go to great lengths to make sure that I'm telling you the whole truth in the show, you know? Like, in the Concrete movie, my tenants, I tell you the exact amount of dollar amount that I charge them for rent.
I was going to ask that.
Yeah.
That's my next question. And that's real.
Yeah, and that's real.
It's a very fair amount to charge for rent.
Yeah, I thank you very much.
Why did you choose to include that in the documentary?
Because the movie's about affordable housing. And I think transparency with stuff like that is really important. And I think that people get away with a lot of bad stuff by not being transparent. And I think about when I was writing season two of How To with like the season that Susan Orlean was on, we were writing the episode about real estate when I'm buying the building, you know, and I'm telling her all about what's happening. And I was like, I'm not sure whether or not to put the price of the home in the movie. And
right.
Susan was like, you have to. Like, you absolutely have to put the exact dollar amount of the...
Because that makes it real.
Yeah, because that makes it real. And you know, and you see that in her work. And, you know, ever since then, I take that very seriously because, you know, these are the things that actually stick with people. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, because you don't usually have that kind of transparency from, you know, from people about their finances.
So Clark and Nelly work on this show.
Yeah.
That's them over there.
Yeah, Clark and Nelly work on this show, and they also worked on How To. Nelly was my star shooter on How To. Clark was a producer since the beginning. Davis and I also own and run a movie theater together.
I wasn't going to do that one yet.
Oh, sorry. It's okay. We can cut that out.
My question for you is, as New York has become prohibitively expensive to make art because of the cost of living, is John Wilson indirectly subsidizing the production of Doomscroll by lowering the cost of rent for our crew?
Yeah, I like the idea of you know, being able to provide, like, you know, housing, you know, to a degree for people doing interesting things in a city, and, you know, and yeah, we often joke about it being, you know, they call it how-to housing, you know.
The how-to hype house?
Yeah, the hype house. Yeah,
I did know some of this before. I didn't know it was your building, but there was one day when we were on set, this was like very early, but Clark and Nelly were, they're talking about a mouse in the basement, and I realized that they lived in the same building. So I want to ask you, according to NYC Local Law 55, property owners are required to take steps to keep their tenants' homes free of pests and mold. As of today's date, is your property in compliance with Local Law 55?
I think so, yeah. We have no mice, right? Yeah, there's no more mice in the basement. Plus, we have a handful of cats in the house, and that helps a lot, you know,
right?
In like a deli kind of way.
I don't know if this will make it into the episode, but I think Clark's wife is also a very successful tenant organizer.
Yeah, and
so
yeah.
You knowingly invited in someone who organizes tenants against their landlord.
Yes. It's kind of it is really funny. I mean, Samantha Samantha is my other tenant, married to Clark, and she's running for state assembly right now and has a history of tenant organizing, you know. And I really support that, and I think she's doing amazing work. And you know, when I was living in Boston in like 2008 to 2011, I didn't have a job. I didn't have anywhere to stay. And Samantha let me live in her walk-in closet for about a year and a half, 2 years maybe. And, you know, there were points where I could overhear her in the kitchen saying that it's like we're living in the same room. and I'm not sure what she was talking about. but all that's to say is that I know she really cares about housing.
Yes.
In that way. And yeah, but I've been going to a lot of campaign events for her, and you know, it is kind of funny because these are like, they are kind of like fuck your landlord parties. And I'm just like, you know, so you know, I support, but I try not to, like, you know, be too heavy-handed in there, just out of respect for the movement.
The last question on this is, are we absolutely sure that Clark is not a Maoist?
I may be housing a lot of political radicals, and, you know, I think that's just the way it is. That's just how it has to be in a city, I think. I don't know if we haven't talked about Mao in a while.
To watch part two of this episode, you can support the show on Patreon. We're about 90 days into the People's Republic of New York City with Zohran as our mayor. Mm-hmm. His platform includes removing scaffolding and increasing public restrooms. Mm. Is Zohran taking his legislative agenda directly from How-To?
I think his staffers definitely had a heavy hand in it somehow. I don't know what he watches.
I heard some rumblings about a connection maybe with the campaign.
Yeah, we shot a video a week or two ago, Zohran and I, about his scaffolding initiative. Yeah.
Oh.
I mean, I don't know if
they didn't tell me this.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know where, okay. I don't know what happened to it. I think the delay of his kind of scaffolding policy has been pushed back so many times at this point. Mm-hmm. They've been trying to get us to make a video together for a little while.
That kind of sounds appropriate with the whole industry.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we finally did it, but then, I don't know, I think there was some domestic or geopolitical incident that
World War III.
That got in the way of, okay. of the
so rollout. we're now leaking this. So we are media, so we're leaking this to force Zohran to release the video, the scaffolding video.
I mean, okay. Yeah, I have the footage, but I think
you'll bring it to WikiLeaks.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
If it never comes out, but they have the other angle, which, you know, I think will probably look kind of cool. But yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, it was really cool that, you know, whether or not he was the one that wanted it to happen, the fact that he's actually doing, or, you know, considering scaffolding as this kind of like quality of life threat and, you know, actual life threat, you know, in a lot of ways. And really working hard to try to get it done sooner, which I think is cool.
When we were talking before, you mentioned that there's a kind of cycle to the renewal of these cities.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think this is why this movie was a little hard to pitch at first, because at first most of what I had was this kind of gloom and doom trivia about like the material that is like nails on a chalkboard to financiers. You know, it's like not something they really want to hear about, because it sounded like I was making a climate change movie, which I wasn't. You know, I think at first.
Oh, because there's CO2 emissions from concrete?
Yeah. I mean, it's like the second or third biggest contributor to global warming.
Right.
Because of CO2 emissions. Yeah. And we're running out of all the sand that we need to make it. And a lot of the existing stuff that's out there is, you know, has like a much sooner expiration date than you would have thought. So I was kind of living with the full dose of all of this really depressing trivia when I was making the film.
Oh, you mean like American infrastructure, like crumbling?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of this kind of thing that I don't know if we're fully acknowledging as like a society, that the
bridges are falling on
people.
Yeah,
the bridges are falling apart. Yeah. Like there's all of this, I mean, you know, as I was making the film, there were a handful of things that happened, you know, some that made it in the film, but of stuff catastrophically failing across the city.
Right.
And, you know, so, but I knew that I wanted to kind of wave a flag in a way, but I also knew that I wanted to make something that was really funny, just because that's like the only way to offset the kind of tragedy of receiving this information.
What is like the half-life or the timeline for, does it have to be rebuilt every 50 years or something like that? I think the Brooklyn Promenade was one of the examples in the film.
The Brooklyn Heights Promenade, where the triple cantilever of the BQE is, that is an especially kind of threatened piece of old concrete infrastructure, because it is a kind of a beautiful design, but it's far past the point of.
For people who don't know at home, it's like a concrete overhang that seems to defy gravity. It's this kind of beautiful shape, but there's like chunks of it that are falling down onto the motorists below.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, half of a dinner plate, you know, a few times over on top of each other.
So the first thing that kind of came to mind when you mentioned the cyclical nature of urban renewal is that there's a lot of metaphors in the film, and there's literally, I'm spoiling some of the plot here, but there are people who run around in a circle on concrete for like kind of a long time.
Yeah.
Who are those guys and why are they doing that?
The people who are disciples of the spiritualist Sri Chinmoy have this race every year where they run for 52 days around the same square block in Queens, in Jamaica. And it's on, you know, a concrete sidewalk. And that was the only entry point I really needed to that world. But, you know, it's a really punishing race.
No kidding.
You know, with no reward at the end outside of this kind of spiritual release that you get from it. And so much of the concrete movie is about cyclical behavior and whether or not cyclical behavior is healthy, or whether or not you need to pierce it sometimes, because you have examples of both, I think, in the work, where like Hallmark as a network is the only network that's growing in viewership right now, because specifically because of the cyclical nature of the...
They do a Christmas movie every year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Multiple. And
they're always the same.
Yeah, and they're always the same, but there's something really kind of comforting and refreshing about that. And, you know, when I go to the Hallmark writing class in the beginning of the film, I really wanted it to... I needed something, like some kind of structure to either embrace or to revolt against. And I feel like that's like a really important way to kind of try to take a kind of check where you are creatively, you know, like if you've been given an assignment or something like that. And I kind of envied the people that were running in circles because they had this structure, because they had this guru that could tell them what to do. And, you know, and I think there are certain parts of our lives that we look to other people, or we look to kind of authorities for that direction. And I mostly just wanted to interrogate in my own life, like where I need external pressure, where I need structure from somewhere else in order to make certain things and just to live, you know. I feel like the, like having a Hallmark structure is this thing that like ended up becoming the spine of the work because it's something almost to work against. You know, I think it's just really hard sometimes when you don't have anything to start with and you're kind of just like staring at this black hole. And I was just trying to prove the strength of just kind of picking something random and just going with it and seeing, like, taking you every step of the way about that, where that takes you.
Even if you picked the most boring topic imaginable for a documentary, you could make a compelling story out of it.
That was the hope. Yeah.
You
did
it. That
was the challenge.
It's a great movie.
Thank you.
It's a great movie. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So in the movie, I now assume that just everything is real.
Mm-hmm.
There's a building where you are on the lease.
Mm-hmm.
And people are on rent strike for like 4 years now.
Yeah.
And you owe these people like $500,000 or something?
Yeah.
Okay. How's that going to work out?
It's, so I'm going to try to find a way to say this without incriminating myself too much.
We do edit the show.
Yeah. Yeah. So. In the film, I the place that I used to live with six or seven other people is off the Wilson stop on the L train.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like a real celebrity over there when I lived there. But the landlords did such a bad conversion on the building that they put fake sprinklers in everywhere, and it just wasn't up to loft code.
Mm-hmm.
So at one point, the fire department came in and shut off the heat and hot water, and the city just said that they've been on rent strike since then. I think since like 2018. Maybe.
So how are they staying warm and getting water?
They've been using hot plates and...
They buy all their water from the store?
It partly just feels like kind of a punk squat for now. But I'm glad that people are still living there. But I think that I was on the lease in this place the whole time I lived there. I lived there for like 7 years or so. And then once I moved out, everyone went on rent strike.
Great.
And,
great timing.
But... the lease had expired with my name on it. And, but the company still kept like sending me these robo emails every single month for like escalating amounts of money.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think the grand total is, something like $500,000 right now that I like owe these people, for this unit that like isn't really safe for people to live in. Even though people do.
How much cement does China use?
China used as much cement between... China used like just as much cement in about 4 years recently as the entire United States did in the past century, you know? And this was some trivia given to me by a sand expert that was in the movie. And...
a lot of infrastructure spending.
Yeah, and... I was just talking to someone in Copenhagen recently that is from China, and they said that it's culturally sometimes you have to build a second house to save up and you build a second house that's in this one area, and it's like a status thing to be able to build this house, but the entire neighborhood, all the neighborhoods are deserted, and it's more just like a kind of like a way to sink your money into this kind of
a real estate investment?
Yeah, somehow.
And they don't live there?
But nobody lives there, and it's kind of a ghost town. I forget the name of the town, but yeah, it was I mean, that's one example of just like the kind of this addiction to this material that certain parts of the world have. And, you know, you look at, I mean, even Japan used so much concrete within the past decade.
And this these houses appreciate faster than just putting your money in the market or something
I think it depreciates.
It's just social prestige.
It's just social prestige.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
To build this decaying house somewhere else, you know.
They could be renting it out at least.
I know, yeah.
That would probably be less prestige, though.
Yeah, I think.
Okay, so it's just a game of people throwing money away for sport, is that?
Yeah, that's what someone was telling me at a bar the other night.
Speaking of documentaries, did you ever see this movie called The Dells?
Oh, yes, I love The Dells.
Do you know the URL where I can stream it for $5.99?
Where is it? Is it on Mubi or something?
It's on memory.is
/the-dells.
I think that was it.
Okay.
You are the co-founder of Low Cinema in Ridgewood. What was the inspiration to start your own movie theater?
I felt like somebody had to do it, you know, open a movie theater. I mean, I think that there used to be movie theaters, multiple ones on every block in the city, you know, and it wasn't weird. You know, I may be wrong, but I feel like the story of a lot of movie theaters is the story of a lot of kind of industries that kind of conglomerated into these larger companies. Like, in smaller theaters used to be just like seen as something that you needed to clean up because it was like usually pornographic or kind of like kind of blue in some way. But, you know, all of these theaters started to get kind of either started to close, get cleaned up in the Giuliani era, and then, you know, now we're left with these Regals and these Lowe's type cinemas that and AMCs that just take, you know, that like they're the only game in town in a certain way.
And they also show pretty specific stuff like Mission Impossible type movies.
Yeah.
Not what you're showing at Lowe.
I mean, no hate to any of the blockbuster movies because, you know, those are fun to show too. But like, I don't know. It's like, I always bring this up. It's like Bed Bath & Beyond or something where it's like, I used to be able to, like, that's where I was buying my bed sheets, you know, or you used to be able to just buy bed sheets at a bunch of different stores in your neighborhood. And then it all became Bed Bath & Beyond. And then that closed and now there's nowhere to buy bed sheets. And now we just need to like reopen the bed sheet stores. You know, it's okay. Like, that's how I feel about the cinema in a lot of ways, where we kind of reached this point, you know, like with like what theaters were in the States, and where like now that they're just like these, there's just like one AMC or Regal in a town. And I know it's probably unrealistic and most people probably won't do it, but I think it would be cool to just think of these smaller cinemas as just like things that can, you know, just reopen and like, you know, the history of cinema is not that long still comparatively. So this could just be a wave where we like kind of reopen these as social spaces, you know, just as you know, even if there is no industry to speak of in the sense that we're used to with Hollywood movies or even mid-level indies being produced, I just believe in the cinema as a social and kind of like a political space.
You have a Frederick Wiseman doc showing right now?
Yeah, we showed Frederick Wiseman recently. We showed Racetrack on 16mm. Yeah, we got the print directly from Zipporah, which I was like, I could not believe we were able to do within a year of opening, you know?
Yeah.
Which is cool.
Do you have any partners in that project?
I started the theater with my good friends Davis Folks and Cosmo Bjorkenheim. I've known them from different parts of my life, but for a while. And, you know, they're both cinephiles and I think just like to have a kind of a community-oriented project that like brings people together.
So, Davis,
Yeah, Davis, also who also works on the show.
That's Davis over there. John Wilson indirectly subsidizing the production of Doomscroll by offering high-wage part-time employment to our crew?
As of right now, I don't know. But yeah, I think I can't tell what is subsidizing what. I don't know.
Okay, I have a few. Bear with me. I've got a few other bits here. So people who worked on How To and also The History of Concrete, we've got a few more collaborators in common. Do you think LJ Frezza, this is our editor that you worked with for a long time, do you think LJ will cut this segment if I tell you his theory about Tower 7?
No. Self-healing concrete is a harder thing to formulate. I think the Romans did it well, which is why people are so fascinated with Roman concrete. But I still don't really know how Roman concrete was made. I don't think anyone does. But
yeah, right. Why is ours falling apart when theirs is like 1,000 years old?
Because that's like the number one thing that people come up to me after the screenings and tells me is that they know what the formula is for Roman concrete.
They do?
Yeah.
Can they share it with the rest of us?
I feel like from what I understand, based off of everything everyone's told me, it's a mix of environmental factors like the volcanic ash, and they used a lot more limestone. Which had more self-healing properties within it. But I intentionally omitted that from the film just because I didn't really want to give anyone any actual answers, you know, to the big questions.
Leave it a little bit of mystery.
Yeah.
Towards the end of the film, you attend the City of Yes Town Hall.
Yes.
What were those debates like?
Well, I went to a Ridgewood Property Owners Association meeting that I was invited to, and that was a lot of neighbors of mine that were being given a speech about the City of Yes by someone who was a bit more gloom and doom about it, who thought that it was going to kind of irrevocably change these kind of quaint neighborhoods into something, you know, which is like a very classic kind of NIMBY kind of refrain. One of my neighbors on my street, he, you know, was talking to the crowd and he was like, look, you know, we care about affordable housing because, you know, because we are the people that give affordable housing to our neighbors. And, you know, he was looking out to a crowd of people who own duplexes, you know, or in Ridgewood. And, if, you know, if that's what you call them, some F3. But yeah, I really believe in that, you know, philosophy that it is to a degree an individual responsibility, you know, of landlord, whoever it is, to like actively do the humane thing, you know, with a tenant. And I know it can be a really complicated issue sometimes, but, you know, with the City of Yes, I think you saw a lot of kind of NIMBY politics come to the forefront. And it was just something I was following for a while because, you know, I wanted the concrete movie to be a bit of a NIMBY movie. You know, I wanted to like have a lot of these, I kind of wanted to put that mentality kind of to the test in a way, while giving them the mic. And
you wanted to challenge the NIMBYs.
I wanted to see what was going on. Hmm. You know,
there's an example in the film on Elizabeth Street. There was a garden, and this was going to be replaced with an affordable housing building.
Yeah, with for
were
seniors.
You a NIMBY or YIMBY on that topic?
I feel like the Elizabeth Street stuff was something I dipped in and out of, and I understand where like someone like Zoran is coming from you know, obviously with housing, I mean, especially like, you know, like seniors, like in Soho, I think that's like a, like obviously something that is like, people we should be considering, but at the same time, like ecologically, when you take green space away, like in certain parts of the city, you never get it back. And it's this, we're at this point where we, you know, and this I feel like is like the more conservative, like kind of part of me coming out where it's, but where it's like, we need like areas for the water to drain into the earth, you know, which we just don't have. And it's causing flooding like crazy.
Right.
And it's, you know, but this is like the same thing, you know, I'm saying the same thing as Vicky does in the City of Yes, like hearing. And, you know, there's this kind of, you become kind of strange bedfellows with like certain kind of parts of the, like the opposite party sometimes,
right.
Like within this kind of NIMBY argument where like, I'm trying to think of it from a material scarcity and environmental perspective, you know, with like not only building with too much concrete, but also like the importance of green space, you know, like how the people who are trying to stop Tony Hawk from building a skate park in Mount Prospect Park.
Right.
Like that, I understand, you know, like I think, but their politics are often, you know, very much focused on the neighborhood, which is important. And I think you should really like invest emotionally in your neighborhood. But, you know, I think that, I don't know, but skaters also need somewhere to go and stuff. I
didn't have a lot of sympathy for those guys.
I didn't want to offer any easy answers to like the NIMBY question because like I more just wanted to open up this kind of conversation and make you interrogate like who, and think about who you are in this situation, you know.
As we wrap up here, I want to say one important thing on the record that you made popular video art for a mass audience in a way that is unparalleled and rare in our generation.
Wow.
And I have so much admiration for your work.
Thank you, Josh.
And you are quite literally putting your money where your mouth is when you talk about your values. So I really appreciate that.
Thank you, man.
The last question I want to ask you here, which is perhaps the most important thing we're going to touch on. What was the plot of Jingleberry?
Oh, wow. Jingleberry was about a young boy whose mother was really sick and he wanted to enter a Christmas house decorating contest to try to win enough money to save his mother's life. But then he also wanted this toy that was really popular. It was basically the plot of Jingle All the Way. But, you know, on like a $3,000 budget.
Wow. Were spending that much in, what was that, high school?
Yeah, high school. I mean, yeah, over time. Yeah, that's wow. About what everything cost probably. But yeah, that was technically the first narrative feature, but the concrete is my first documentary feature.
John Wilson.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
All right, thanks, guys.
John, thank you. To watch part two of this episode, you can support the show on Patreon.